I want to tell you this morning about a guy by the name of Bayard Rustin. I find him a fascinating man, a person I often find myself disagreeing with, yet continuing to respect in the end. And he did hold some problematic views, especially towards the end of his life. But he's just one of those people who is so influential in the grand scheme of things that I feel myself drawn to him and fascinated by this larger-than-life character. And to hear me talk, if you listen to who I like, you'll know I love larger-than-life characters. Now, I wonder if some of you are thinking, if he was so larger than life, why haven't I heard of him? Well, there's a good reason for that. You see, unless you study a lot about the history of the civil rights movement, you probably have not come across his name. Rustin was a background character, serving as a strategist for leaders such as A. Philip Randolph and Martin Luther King Jr. In fact, it's been said that had it not been for Rustin, there might not have been a March on Washington in 1963. It was a strategy of his that became a turning point for the civil rights movement and gave a platform for King to deliver his I Have a Dream speech. His legacy is keenly felt through and through in African-American circles today, and many still consider him a mentor. I'd like to thank Rustin as a Mirror Universe Steve Bannon, a man with the ear of leaders who used his influence for good. But you may ask, if Rustin was such an important character, why was he in the background much of the time? Now, you might hazard to guess that it might be because Rustin wasn't good at making speeches. But by most accounts, Rustin was an amazing speaker, and he frequently found himself addressing topics that were important to him. No, Rustin wasn't in the periphery because he couldn't hold his own with King or Randolph. Rustin was in the periphery because the civil rights movement put him there, scared that he would damage their efforts to get civil rights legislation passed. In fact, Rustin was considered such a liability that King asked him to leave Montgomery during the bus boycott. And he was even once shepherded out of town in the trunk of a car to keep a reporter from exposing his deep, dark secret to the world. So what was Rustin's crime that was so heinous that a justice movement didn't want to be seen with him? It may not be what you think. Rustin was gay, and he was a communist in the 1950s and the 1960s. Yes, the civil rights movement was so absolutely proud to use Rustin's knowledge of organizing and pick his brain for theory and strategy. They were happy to have him on their side and might even have said they accepted their brother for who he was. They just didn't want to be seen with him. If he could only hide himself so the neighbors all over America couldn't find out what a justice movement was doing to harbor a man disenfranchised for more than just the color of his skin. If he could only just hang out there in the back somewhere by the janitor's closet where he won't cause a scene. I can just imagine what they were thinking. We can't become known as the gay movement. We don't want non-communists to think they can't join us. We're scared what the white folks will say, since their support is so fragile and tenuous as it is. Well, if we accept Rustin, people might think we're gay, or a communist, or gay communists. Now, King is another man I greatly respect. And some would argue that his and other leaders' treatment of Rustin was a strategic decision, that openly affirming a gay man would have been detrimental to their cause. But this is a flawed logic that denied a great man his dignity. To quote the poet Emma Lazarus, "Until we are all free, none of us are free." Too often, through the history of humanity, we see instances where begrudging tolerance is granted to those who are different, where they're allowed to sit at the back of the class as long as they don't make too much noise. They're not placed back there because we respect them. They're placed in the back because we're ashamed of them. Early free thinkers like Thomas Paine and Voltaire, gay men like Ruskin and Oscar Wilde, trans women such as Marsha P. Johnson, Sylvia Rivera, and Miss Major, who were instrumental to the founding of the gay liberation movement, but were pushed to the back of their own movement. Women of color like Audre Lorde and bell hooks, and countless so many others. They're relegated to the back because people have been scared that their difference is catching, that somehow it will rub off on them, and they'll be forced to bathe in tomato juice just to get rid of the stench in their clothes. Like Crispin, the dragon who couldn't breathe fire in our story this morning, they're banished, whether explicitly or implicitly, for being different. Only to have hipsters say decades or centuries after their deaths how important their contributions to society have been. So imagine, just imagine, how radical it must have seemed when a strange little religion that some people claim is a cult, called Unitarian Universalism, decided in 1985 to make their very first principle the inherent worth and dignity of all persons. Now, we certainly weren't the first to think of this idea. We almost certainly borrowed it from our humanist source. But in light of how humans so often treat one another, just think of how radical this statement is. It's a statement to the Bayard Rustins and the Crispins of the world that we're not going to ask you to sit in the back of the room. It means we're going to look you, each of you, in the eye and declare, yes, yes, you can be one of us. You can be a member of our church just as you are. You can explore your spirituality with us, befriend us, be a part of our community, and maybe even become a congregational leader or even a minister if you want to run up some debt. All without changing an iota of who you are. It means you can stand right up here and tell your truth, and we won't worry about what those nosy neighbors think. Let them think ill of us. We know there's nothing wrong with it, even if they're right. Whereas other churches may ask for repentance or change to sit in the pews, we'll dare to say, sit. Sit right there. No prior approval or credit check needed. We'll say, all are welcome. And we damned well mean it. and we do take flack for it. I hear all the time from colleagues, all the time, that their church has been labeled by conservatives in the larger community, the gay church, or the black church, or the disabled church, merely for who happens to be in the pulpit or who the leaders are. And there may be only one black person or gay person in the entire place, but if they're visible, they're the gay church or the black church. Because the world gets scared and sees a narrow definition of a person, unable to see how complex and beautiful they really are. And our first principle calls us to say, that's okay. And if you don't like it, in the words of Mindy from Animaniacs, okay, I love you, bye-bye. Hospitality and justice aren't about being liked by everyone. It's testimony, just how many groups we have welcomed in over the years. What started as two Christian heresies, the outsiders who are so extreme that some Christians wouldn't claim us, turned into an unprecedented experiment in the power of radical love and acceptance. Just think of all the groups over the years who have found a home in these walls when no one else wanted them. Transcendentalists, humanists, naturalists, female leaders and ministers, communists and socialists, anti-war activists, pagans, LGBTQ people, and people from just about every major world religion. That's quite a list. And we didn't just welcome these people in because their name looks neat on our membership rolls and pledge cards. We welcome them in because we believe in them, believe they deserve a place of honor as well, because our faith has always been kind of outsiders to the greater world, daring to invite anyone to the table who is also able to recognize the inherent worth and dignity we hold so dear. That's not to say we've always done this radical world and worth and dignity thing perfectly. Unitarian Universalists are merely human, no matter what we might think some days. And indeed, I've preached before about the shortcomings in our history, especially when groups first come to us seeking shelter from the storm. And we'll keep getting it wrong, because we're not ever going to be perfect, no matter what Billy Joel tries to tell us. We're going to keep stumbling, with the hope that in the end, we'll find some way to get it right. I'll come back to that stumbling next week. But first, I wanted to touch on just how important this experiment is. I think it's safe to say we've all been disturbed by the events of the last couple of weeks, with hatred and disregard of this inherent worth and dignity on full display. And this follows years, years of watching Black, Brown, and Indigenous people murdered in extreme acts of force. I watched in horror as the events of Charlottesville unfolded, not surprised, but saddened to read my colleagues' reflections on the ground about how they were being surrounded by neo-Nazis and white nationalists. I marched in solidarity with them the following Sunday and spoke about how important it is that people of color and Jewish people see we have their backs at times like this. And we Unitarian Universalists held the line on our beliefs. We were out there demanding justice, declaring the truth of our first principle through word and action. And indeed, it's true that marching alone will never bring justice. But it's making an impact. Yesterday in Boston, 20,000 counter-protesters descended on 100 or so neo-Nazis and white nationalists. It was said that police outnumbered the racist protesters at yesterday's Boston rally. And they made it clear as day. We will not allow them to push us backwards, to force our siblings to go back in the shadows, to sit at the back of the bus ever again. Our belief in inherent worth and dignity is spreading as people stand up and declare that any force that would cause us to hate other people will not find a hold in our country. Even the president's fellow party members are standing up, and it's incredible to watch. We must continue to hold our first principle, not only when crisis is brewing, but week after week in our congregation, because it is much easier to demand inherent worth and dignity when we're practicing it on a regular basis. And what better place than our churches, where we can be a testimony to the world? And it's also a place where we can practice our radical welcome. A wise colleague once said that questions every church and every organization should be asking is, who is not here and why? We need to figure out who's not here all the time, or even who's not in leadership, and figure out how to widen our circle to include them. This is not a practice of judgment, but a practice that recognizes Billy Joel is wrong. We're not perfect just the way we are. We need to keep finding ways to bring in those who have previously not had a voice to come in, to sit in the front rows in a place of honor, and be with us as we struggle to make sense of the world we live in together. I believe in our movement, or else I would not be standing before you today. And I believe we will keep finding the Rustins of the world who have been seated in the shadows for far too long, their accomplishments credited to others, and ask them to sit up here with us. Not because it will help our congregations grow significantly in numbers, or because it will gain us friends in many parts of the wider community, but because it's the right thing to do. We will look at them and tell them, yes, sit up here. It must be hard to see back there where you've been all this time. And when we bring this into the greater world, I believe we have the power to transform it radically into a world where no one need fear being an outsider again, affirmed for who they are and loved right through and through. May it be so.